Welcome, everyone, to the Hitting the Canvas Wrestling Podcast. I am your host, Matt Herrick. Currently, I am absolutely exhausted, recovering from numerous different ailments, and joined this week by our regular co-host, Justin Cam, who took over hosting duties last week for me, considering I was laid out in bed. But we also have a special guest co-host, guest, I don't know. He was on the show recently. You may know him better as his Twitter handle in the WWE Creative. On Twitter, it's at WWE_creative-ish or something like that. Rob Karpeles, how's it going, Rob? What's it been like in the all of 2 weeks, I think, since you've been on the show?
It's been, the world's completely changed. As apparently has my Twitter handle, it's WWE_creative_ish.
See, that's how unprofessional I'm
being.
I'm like, I take 1 or 2 weeks off and I just completely lose all sense of professionalism and responsibility. And yeah, I'm just happy I have an actual top five ready for this week. Last time I was winning it. But we are talking our top five worst debuts by eventual world champions. Seems awfully vague, and it was vague when we pitched the idea. Let me give you a quick synopsis of how our criteria worked before we jump into anything. How it worked is we're looking at basically the entire realm of professional wrestling. It was any bad debut in any federation, any company, any bad debut by a wrestler that eventually became a world champion under whether it be a different gimmick, the same gimmick, just better, or whatever the case may be, in the same company or a different company, made no difference. It was just, it has to be that same person. That was what we were going off of. World champions that we're considering with the federations are all, they had to be recognized by Pro Wrestling Illustrated and their family magazines at one point or another. So it's world champions that would consider it obviously WWF or WWE, WCW, NWA. And then there's also, TNA, and we also included ECW. Because during the Attitude Era, they were actually considered a world championship. Their world champion was actually considered a world championship for about all of, I think, a year or two before they went out of business. But, yeah, that was our criteria for this show and for the range of people that we can choose from. So it may seem like there was a lot to cover there and a lot of people to look at, but there wasn't that many. It was a little difficult, mainly, I think, on my end because of just the scope of what we were looking at and what we could actually consider being truly successful or a truly bad debut. I know, Rob, you said you came up with your top five pretty quickly. What jumped out at you once I threw this topic at you?
The main thing is, and to your point, you know, you look at the massive list that you think that exists of all these champions for all these companies. There really aren't that many guys that you're talking about, and most people, for whatever reason, didn't get saddled with bad debuts. The one thing about Vince and the WWE is when he wants a guy to be champion, you know, he'll start him from day one and protect him. And a lot of the champions that you get from WCW or from the NWA, they didn't get a lot of terrible gimmicks. They were just kind of themselves going around. So when you look at the list of all the companies and you look at all the champions, there are maybe seven or eight guys that jump out at you as yeah, they had some pretty rotten debuts. But for the most part, a lot of the guys that held a major title, and I don't really consider TNA a major title, but a lot of the guys who held a major title, you know, started off strong and kind of continued. So when you see some of these guys and you go, I can't believe that they made it, that's what I put on my list.
Yeah, for me, it was sort of the same reasoning that you had. It was more of the guys that started off a while ago and either only recently or much later in their career they achieved championship success. So it was almost kind of like a paid their dues idea of them becoming a world champion. So I think mine have maybe longer careers before they became world champion. So that might be why I had a wider range, because a lot of the guys that I have on here had horrible, horrible debuts. But because they stuck around in the business for so long, people kind of forgot how they started out and eventually just came to accept them for what they were. Cam, what was your compiling your list like going over the past week or so?
I think I've kind of followed the same model you did. I looked at guys that stuck around and kind of just got horrible, horrible debuts in one company and then stuck around and they got better debuts in another company and eventually became champions of those companies. And I do consider TNA not a major title, so I didn't include anybody that works for TNA.
Honestly, if I look back on it, I don't think I have anybody that won the TNA championship. I think I had people who won the NWA-TNA championship, so technically they could be considered an NWA champion. Just looking back at title legacies and histories, they were grouped into the NWA section of it before it was vacated and I think picked up by... I don't know who it was. I know Adam Pearce really shotgunned it back into mainstream attention. But yeah, before they severed the ties with it, for people who don't know, TNA was originally part of the NWA conglomeration that really doesn't exist too much anymore. But their world champion for NWA or for TNA was also the NWA world champion. So they kind of had the same thing going on for a while until they grew to a big enough company that they had their own world champion. And I think Kurt Angle was their first recognized TNA world heavyweight champion. Justin, what was going through your mind when this idea and this list came about?
Well, initially, I just kind of looked for, you know, the worst of the worst debuts when it came up for looking for world champions. And then I end up, a handful of people on my list similar to yours, Matt, kind of like guys that started off bad but ended up paying their dues because they've had long careers in wrestling and ended up getting to the point where they became the world champion, the WWE champion, one of those championships. So that's the strong majority of my list, too.
Okay, so we could have a lot of the same people among our lists, and we could have a very, very wide range of either very good or very awful people. It all depends on how important we think some of these people are. But before we get into any of that, it's been a couple weeks since we had Rob on the show. It's been a couple of weeks since I've been on the show, just because of our week off and because I was sick last week. Rob, I want to get your opinion. I didn't watch Raw live. I'm tending to watch it on a tape delay more recently, just because it's easier for me. But the first thing I saw, obviously, in the message boards and on every single website as soon as Raw was over or while Raw was going on, was not only the debut of the Wyatt family, but the Husky Harris chants during the Wyatt family's debut. While watching, I'll just throw out my opinion right now, while watching the debut and the way that the production crew was able to seamlessly transition from a a promo video, a pre-taped promo video, obviously, into the live event arena, except for the fact that he was using a halogen lantern instead of a candle, and then proceeded to blow out the halogen light. I didn't really get that part. But besides that, I thought it looked great. It was something completely different. Reminded me back of the days when somebody like, ironically, somebody like Kane debuted, and you didn't know what to expect. You didn't know what was going on. It was creepy. People were kind of wondering what's going to happen next. And I thought they succeeded very well. And then all of a sudden, you get the lovely crowd not being able to let go of the past. And since we're talking about awful debuts here, being able to let go of the idea that this guy once played Husky Harris on WWE TV. What was your initial reaction, especially being a former writer for WWE Creative? Do you cringe when you feel that, or do you feel like that these guys are strong enough that people are going to completely forget about that in a week or so and just be able to move forward?
My hope is that they're going to completely forget about it and move forward. I've talked to a couple of other former writers, and we all absolutely love everything about the way this gimmick was put together. The vignettes have been great. The fact that they've been using the music they were using in NXT, they didn't tweak any of their, you know, identities. And then they come out there, and you get a smart-ass crowd that wants to chant Husky Harris because they think it's funny. Hopefully it was a 1 week anomaly and it was Baltimore. I think I said something when the show was on of, you know, this kind of explains the wire. Baltimore is a fairly useless town, in a lot of regards. And that's not just cause I'm a Giants fan and I'm bitter about the Ravens. It mainly comes down to the fact that they had a lot of unique videos and then you had two big guys come out and beat up Kane. After a dead match in a dead segment, Kane and Christian fought to complete silence because the audience had no idea how to react, and they chose to sit on their hands. So they were bored to tears with this match. Match ends, Wyatt family comes out, they jump Kane, and we just saw this with The Shield. And one of the things I was talking about with one of the other writers is they're going to have a tough time differentiating the Wyatt family and The Shield, because there's only so many big names that they can really attack. And Kane has been beaten down and beaten down and beaten down by so many people that he kind of lost that mystique. So for all the cool backwoods stuff, they really couldn't give a payoff immediately that was going to be satisfying. I think they're going to recover. I'm hoping the Husky Harris thing is not going to be like the Ryback Goldberg chant, and it's just going to kind of be a one-off, obnoxious whatever. I didn't really see, for the SmackDown spoilers, if the crowd was still chanting Husky Harris, but I will say I went to a house show about 3 weeks ago, and the Wyatt family was on there, and the entire crowd was really into it. I mean, Bray Wyatt worked against R-Truth. Crowd totally bought into him. They were creeped out by him. They responded correctly. So I do think the audience will rebound. But that Husky Harris chant is going to be one of those things that they're going to talk about for years, and eventually it'll wind up on a top five list of, you know, bad debuts for a future champion.
Yeah, for me, it was something that I brought up in my the 10 Thoughts column I wrote for the site on Monday was I had the same reaction as you did as far as They have two stables right now, legitimate stables that are consisted of three people that are attacking people. And yes, there's a lot of differences between the two of them, and there's a lot of similarities. And it's going to be interesting to see whether or not they match them together, them being the Wyatt family and the Shield. The idea that I had was simply for them to just go full force into it and say that, and if you want to turn the Shield at this point, I mean, it might be too soon for him, and I think it's definitely too soon for Dean Ambrose. But you go with the storyline of that the Shield is always working towards a purpose and always working together and always focused on a certain goal compared to the Wyatt family, who just wants chaos and as Bray Wyatt says, watch the world burn and basically tear everything down. I think that's a good way to differentiate the two stables and a good way to have people choose sides between the two of them. But I don't think they can run the same gambit of them coming out and just appearing and attacking people again. It's going to have the same – it's not going to have the same impact as the Shield did. I would have liked to see for their debut maybe a little bit more of a standoff between them and Kane, only to show that they are bigger than Kane. I like the idea of these new monsters are taking out the old monster. I thought there was a lot of symbolism there that maybe the announcers weren't really too clued in on, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, and it went over the head of a lot of people. But you had the new creepy monster guys coming in and taking out the resident monster of the WWE for the last 10, 15 years. I thought you could have worked a lot with that. And you instead just threw on the lights and had them attack, and there wasn't really any, like, build or any tension built up between it. And there was a nice part at the end where they were just kind of looking over them, but that's when the Husky Harris chant started. It's like you said, it's going to be one of those things where we're hopeful that people want to buy into these characters and want to just sit back and enjoy it and really just let it play out on TV or in the arena and just see how it progresses without wanting to be too involved in, like, making themselves a character. Justin knows a lot about this since he was in the New Jersey crowd the night after WrestleMania. Now everybody's trying to be the night after WrestleMania. It's starting to get a little tired. But besides that point, I think they really did a great job, and the crowd kind of knocked them down a peg. I'm just hoping that they're able to recover from this, and it's something that we can just look back on as an anomaly and just say, okay, well, yeah, that was dumb, and I'm glad that they were able to get past that fairly quickly. 2 cents from Justin Cam. Justin, you first, just throw it out there just so everybody gets their 2 cents in on the Wyatts.
Yeah, when it happened, I hated it. I don't like doing it in the first place. Like you guys said, I don't get the idea of having to live in the past all the time like that. And I was surprised how quickly the crowd actually did transition, because when they first came out and when they initially came onto the stage, there was actually a pop and the crowd was excited to see them. And I just had no idea. There's a few smart fans in the audience try to be cool and do that. And like I said, I kind of said it on Twitter during the show that I just don't get the point in doing it. I don't see what it accomplishes as a fan other than trying to make it look like you're a smart guy. I thought the whole Wyatt family promos leading up to it throughout the show were very good. As I said in my review, if you've ever seen movies, they were very House of a Thousand Corpses / Devil's Rejects-ish as far as the whole, like, you know, house in the whole back part of the forest and all that. So I thought everything was very well done leading up to it. I hope it's something that's just a one-off and it was just some stupid fans doing it one time, but it's one of those things where you never know, as far as WWE fans go, what you're going to get in the next crowd you go to. Like you said, I was in New Jersey for WrestleMania. It was a cool one-time experience. Now people think it'll be cool to try to do it again, but it's not. It's one of those things where it's only good for one time and nothing else replicates it. So I hope it's a one-time, one-off thing, and I just hope the Wyatts continue to do well enough where the fact that they don't care about Husky Harris' chance anymore and Bray Wyatt himself gets over as that gimmick.
Yeah, like you said, before I throw it over to Cam, just to bring up the production-wise, as a lot of our listeners know, I'm still working in television. Rob, I know you work for a sports organization. I don't think you do anything on the television side, do you?
I do not.
Okay. Just as far as the production value for the Wyatt vignettes and everything as that goes, that's one situation and one example of why I wish I could still work in a company like the WWE. Because you are able to put something out on television that is completely different than anything else that your company is representing and have it stand out because it is so damn good and so different. It's hard to do in the company that I work for now. I work for ESPN, and it's a news organization where we have to pretty much put everything straightforward. I can't come out and make Aaron Hernandez vignette look like a Wyatt Family promo. Yes, it might be fitting, but it could be looked at a little skewed in the news media outlet world. So that might be a little wrong. But if I worked for a company like the WWE or another entertainment company, that's the type of stuff that I would want to work on. That's the type of stuff I want to cut. If you look at my Twitter page, I posted something recently for the X Games that I did on Ninja Houston, where I did a sizzle reel for the X Games, and it's very stylistic, it's very different, it's very X Games. And those are the things where you'll be sitting in an edit room, and there'll be 8 or 10 hours or several days, you'll be working on this thing, and you'll keep tweaking it. And it comes out looking great, and you just love doing it, and it feels like no time has passed at all. That's what it feels like. The whole Wyatt Family vignettes and their whole gimmick and all the work that's being put into this, it really does feel like a labor of love for somebody who's ever behind the scenes, either writing it or the whoever's producing it, whoever's editing it. Who's ever working on these characters and working on not just the guys in the ring and the guys in front of the camera, but the guys behind the scenes. They're doing a fantastic job of post-production and making it stand out. And you don't see many things stand out in wrestling today. These guys are doing a tremendous job with it. Cam, what is your initial reaction? I know you and I have both been covering NXT for a while now. But just basically based off of the Raw debut and leading up to Raw, what were your thoughts on Monday?
First off, I hate when crowds try to get themselves over. I hate it. They're not part of the entertainment. I hate when I go to house shows and I hear what chance I'm over, what chance. I hate when fans do that. They just need to act accordingly. Like everyone said, the Jersey crowd was a nice one-touch, one-time thing, and those Baltimore fans should just really be ashamed of themselves. I thought their debut was fantastic. They stripped it down to basic wrestling. There was no pyro. There was nothing spectacular. They had Bray Wyatt carried that kerosene lamp or whatever it was, and that was just it. I mean, I think that it was just beautifully done. I thought all of their vignettes were perfect. I think that it's going to be a one-time deal with the Husky Heritage chance. I think it's just going to be just a one-time thing. I think people are buying into the Wyatt hype. I think there was a lot of hype going into it's stable, so I think people are already buying in. As you said, like Justin said, there was a huge pop when you heard their music. People already knew what their music was. So, I mean, the people were doing their research. I think that they should keep the Shield and the Wyatt Family apart. I think that's the only way they're going to need to do it. They're going to have to come up with something for the Wyatt Family to be different from the Shield. And I think, real quick, that I think Kane is kind of just their introduction to the, quote, WWE Universe. I think quickly they're going to get away from just attacking people, and they're going to try to do something different. And I predicted this a couple weeks ago on the show with Justin that one of the members of the Wyatt Family will give him the Money in the Bank and win it, and it looks like that might happen.
Well, it looks like it might happen that they'll get into the Money in the Bank. I'm not too sure they'll win it, but
I think they're going to win it.
I don't think they're going to win it. But that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about Money in the Bank, and I'm not going to get into argument with you this early on in the show. But, okay, let's move on. We talked enough about probably the biggest story coming out so far this week. But let's move into our top five. And it's a rather long, hard-to-explain one, kind of. If you get the idea, you kind of can roll with it. But it's top five worst debuts of future world champions. That's the quickest way that I could sum it up. We're going to count down 5-1 like we always do. And as is custom, we are going to let our guest Mr. Rob WWE Creative, go first with his number five.
All right. I can't say that mine are necessarily in a particular order, but I guess I can kind of work it. My number five is going to be the most recent one. It's going to be Dolph Ziggler. I picked it a little bit due to the fact that I was heavily involved in him having two of the worst debuts that a future world champion ever had. Dolph's first debut in WWE programming was as Kerwin White's caddy. The gag, for those of you who thankfully don't remember it, was Chavo Guerrero was trying to pretend to be a white guy with dyed blonde hair, and he came out in a golf cart and wore a stupid sweater. And we were kind of instructed he should have a caddy, and he should have just an all-American white bread-looking guy be his caddy. And Dolph Ziggler just happened to be backstage one night. We sent a PA out to go buy some caddy clothing, and we threw him out there. He didn't even have a name. So that kind of indicates that when they first saw him, they didn't think, you know what, that guy's a future world champion. They thought, that guy's standing here and he has nothing better to do. Let's just throw him out there. And he was a lackey to one of the worst gimmicks that got thrown out there ever. I know, Matt, you and I, we kind of touched on Kerwin White last time. But it was an awful, unmemorable debut. And then his second terrible debut was as a member of the Spirit Squad. And not only was he a member of the Spirit Squad, he was probably the least member of the Spirit Squad. That was designed basically to get over Ken Doan, or Kenny, who was supposed to be the blue chipper future of the company. The company cared about Mitch because they thought that he had some kind of charisma, just in the same way they think Brad Maddox has charisma. But I'm not getting on the Brad Maddox thing because that guy, I must be missing something here. There was Mike Mondo, who was probably the number three guy in the Spirit Squad because he was the only guy who could really work a match. Then there was Johnny Jeter, who Paul Heyman was incredibly high on. And Nick Nemeth was just sort of the fifth guy. They needed something for him. They threw him out there. Nothing about that said, this guy's going to be a world champion. And he was essentially buried a second time. His third time, coming out as Dolph Ziggler, his gimmick was a rib. He had no character other than the fact that, and Matt, I'm sure you can attest to this, when you're first backstage at a show and you're working in any capacity, you have to introduce yourself to everybody. And the writers live in such a bubble that the only thing that we ever reference is what goes on in our day-to-day lives as writers. And it's annoying when you have a million people coming up to you every week because the company runs through employees like they're going out of style. And they come up, and you get someone that shakes your hand, and then the next week they're gone. So the gag was, we should just have a wrestler who goes out and shakes everybody's hand and introduces himself. That's not something that screams, you're going to be a future world champion and you're protected. It's, we came up with a funny idea, and we're just going to throw it on the first guy we see.
Yeah, for well, first, before we get into that, because Dolph Ziggler is I have a list of, full disclosure, I have a list of about 20 guys that I'm just going to pick and choose five guys that you guys aren't going to choose, just to throw it out there. But he's on that list. But first, quick question. I don't know if you know this or not, but was Ziggler, or should just say, was Nemeth backstage for a dark match? Or did they actually look at OVW and say, okay, who is our whitest frat guy that we can bring up and throw together with Chavo?
No, he just happened to be the whitest frat guy who was hanging out backstage. We were in some town close to Ohio Valley, and they always kind of bring out a group of about 8 or 10 guys just to come backstage, meet people, and that's how Bobby Lashley wound up on TV in the first place. But literally, Nemeth had no idea what a caddy did. He said he's never golfed in his life, didn't understand the rules. And we just said, just stand there quietly, carry the golf clubs, and hope for the best.
Right. Yeah, that's essentially what he did, too, until the unfortunate passing of Eddie Guerrero and everything kind of went up in smoke. And, like, you hate to say it, but it really was – not so much a blessing for the eventual Dolph Ziggler, but it was kind of a wake-up call where it was, yeah, he was young enough where he was able to be sent back down to OVW and just kind of hang around and hope to get a second chance, and then his second chance came out of this cheerleading gimmick, which he wasn't even originally penned to be in, I don't believe. I believe that Elijah Burke was originally supposed to have his spot, and he said no. So he kind of got lumped into two different gimmicks that he wasn't supposed to have. And then when he did come up, yeah, he was brought up and given a gimmick as a rib. He was brought up for the entertainment of Vince McMahon. That's how that gimmick played out. It was go around, shake everybody's hand, and basically bring what's backstage out onto TV. That's what's going to get over. That's what people want to see. It's not, but that is the general mindset, and that's how he was introduced. There was absolutely nothing for him to get over on except for his in-ring work. And even that took a while because I believe he was squashed within seconds for his first couple months of being on TV. It took him a while.
He got hit with a wellness policy violation while he was doing the just backstage introduction stuff. They had him doing all the shaking his hand. All of a sudden, he got nabbed, and then he's off television. So that means automatically 2 or 3 months of just getting flattened every week.
Right. And for him, luckily, that paid off because one of his strengths is being able to sell for people. And he can fly around with the best of them. And it's going to hurt him in the long run because he's throwing his body around like he's renting it and that he doesn't own anything. But his main strength right now is his ability to sell. And I said this in one of my Raw reviews is that, yes, he's trying to get over as babyface now, and I know his strength is selling, but he had a match against Jinder Mahal where he only hit, I think, 2 or 3 offensive maneuvers. It's like, come on, the guy's a babyface. You want to be able to show off some of his moves, and considering the fact that he is nicknamed the show-off, give him a little bit more offense than just a dropkick in his finisher. But besides that, I mean, yeah, the debut was absolutely terrible. He's succeeded to some extent. I think it's still a little out there only because he's had two title reigns. He's really only had one. And that one reign was about a week long because he was out with a concussion for most of it. So I think the ballot might still be a little bit out on how successful he's going to be as a world champion. We all expect him to get that belt back at some point, but he's a guy who's held the title for a day, or not even a day, a couple hours, and technically a month, but it was more like a week, and it was off of a cash-in of Money in the Bank. It wasn't even off of a full match. Justin, what do you have to add to Dolph Ziggler as Rob's number 5?
I have to add that Dolph Ziggler was on my list. He's much higher up on my list. Basically, I don't know if you could find anybody that's had 3 worse debuts in pro wrestling than Dolph Ziggler. I didn't even know which one to include. They were all so bad. I mean, the Caddy one was bad. The Spirit Squad, I don't know what the thinking was, Rob. Probably you know better about Spirit Squad, why they even came up as a group like that, why they thought they would get over as heels. I mean, it's a corny gimmick that I don't think would have gotten anywhere. I mean, they had a few with DX, and Vince McMahon had hired them to take out DX, but I don't think they ever had any chance whatsoever of getting over with that gimmick. And then his whole, like you said, that whole backstage introducing himself to everybody, it was just so bad. And it's a tribute to Dolph that, you know, hard work pays off. He just kept busting his butt for the last few years in WWE, and he finally is paying off now. Like you said, Matt, I don't know what's going to happen. I had hopes for his face turn. I still do, but I really didn't like that promo he gave on Raw this past Monday. So, like you said, I think the verdict is still out on Dolph. We know he can work in the ring. We know that he can put on a good match with almost anybody. It's just a matter of how the WWE handles this face turn, and hopefully the crowd sticks behind him throughout it.
Yeah, Rob, quickly, on Raw, I made the mention of just seeing, after seeing him paired back up with AJ, obviously, they're probably going to go with a full dumping angle where Dolph finally decides, hey, you know what, you're not a nice chick and I'm going to embarrass you and dump you and get a massive face pop. But there was also, with his promo and the horrible segment he had with Alberto Del Rio, it seemed to me that they might be a little bit hesitant in turning him babyface. And I don't know if that was just me and how bad that segment was, but it seemed like they were so strong and so behind him when it first started, and now they keep giving him little things here and there where it isn't a full baby face turn, it isn't a full heel mode, but it's not even like the Randy Orton keeping the heel tactics while also beating up on a bad guy. The segment on Raw was so bad, it just seemed like they're kind of taking a step back from focusing on him. Did you get that sense, or is it still full steam ahead with Ziggler?
I have to agree with you. I think that they are muddying the waters with him because I think they're trying to be a little bit pregnant with whether or not Dolph Ziggler is going to be a baby face or a heel. They tried to do this double turn because Alberto Del Rio was not getting over as a baby face. It's not really much of a surprise. You gave him a terrible character that was this cheesy, pandering, I love America, I'm going to smile baby face. Crowd's not going to buy it. The crowd was cheering for Dolph Ziggler because he was entertaining, he was cocky, he was a jerk, and people are always going to cheer the heel jerk. But then when you turn a baby face, he now would have the same problem CM Punk had. Vince doesn't let his baby faces have the kind of edge that they need. And they started pulling back on what made Dolph Ziggler Dolph Ziggler. And the second, he was selling for Jinder Mahal, of all people, it was already ballgame. And right now, they don't know what the hell they're doing with him. I don't think they know what they're doing with the majority of the company at this point, based on the way it's gone the past 2 or 3 weeks. But that promo in the middle of a match that accomplished absolutely nothing signified that they don't want to make him a full babyface. And they don't necessarily want to pull him away from AJ because him and AJ are a great duo, and the two of them with Big E Langston was working. And they can't seem to figure out a way to get everything they want all at once, so they're hedging their bets. You know, the crowd on Sunday, you're going to be in Philadelphia. It's going to be a smart crowd. They're going to cheer the hell out of Dolph Ziggler, and hopefully he kind of rises to the occasion and the company can be calm and go forward with him as some sort of a cocky baby face. But if they want to be another smart-ass crowd and start chanting for Del Rio because they think chanting C is a lot of fun, then the company is going to go into knee-jerk panic mode again, and they're probably going to ruin both characters.
Yeah, that was the feeling I was getting, and I said the same thing, is that I'm hoping that Philadelphia is going to play out the way that everybody expected them to play out and how they were going to react, say, 2 weeks ago in cheering for Ziggler and having him have a massive CM Punk-esque pop as if he's in Chicago, simply because of how good he is in the ring. It's going to be interesting to see on Sunday. Cam, what do you have to say about Rob Summer 5?
I have Dolph Ziggler a little higher on my list too, just like Justin. I actually do remember the current White Caddy. That is what I have down as his worst debut. Actually, to quote Rob, they need to change him to just a tweener. He's been a middle guy the whole time. They don't know what to do with him, and he's going to eventually end up on the list of the worst careers that WWE destroyed.
Yeah, he's going to be a guy who, unless, like Rob said, unless Philadelphia rises to the occasion and really calms the nerves of WWE, that's basically all it is. It's making sure that You gotta, and when I say you, I mean the WWE fans, have to show faith in the people that you like. Because if you don't, it goes into panic mode, and we get back to the very safe programming that's become very stale over the past couple of years. But, okay, so that was Rob's number five, and Justin and Cam's number something. I kind of figured that was going to happen at some point. And just for Justin, you said you don't think there's anybody else out there who had more than three bad debuts. There's somebody else on one of our lists that has more than three bad debuts. Trust me. Okay. I'm gonna go into my number five real quick, considering both of you guys already revealed one of your numbers. I'll throw out one of mine in here. And one of mine is Booker T. And it's gonna be his there could be two different ones. His more well known one is as Kane. Yes, Kane in WCW, a part of Harlem Heat. Before it was Harlem Heat, as we know and remember Harlem Heat, was Harlem Heat coming down to the ring in chains and shackles with the white Colonel Parker as their manager. That was a lot of problems and in such a small little image. But that was dropped very quickly. But even before that, he was in... I want to say it was the AWA. It could have been the UWF, but he was originally named G.I. Bro. Yes, he was G.I. Bro before he was G.I. Bro in WCW in the late 1990s. Started out as that. That was his moniker. That's what he went at. He was supposed to be the Black Sergeant Slaughter. He was going to take over the country, rise to the occasion, be a strong African-American influence for all those young African-American males, and go on to be a world champion, left the UWF or AWA, wherever it was, and then became a slave to Colonel Robert Parker for a couple of months before Harlem Heat, and then rebuilt his career into Harlem Heat, one of the best tag teams in WCW's history, and then eventually a WCW... world champion towards a time when the WCW World Championship didn't mean anything, but finally made his legacy cemented in the WWE as King Booker during both Rob and our time at WWE in one of SmackDown's glory periods with King Booker and his royal court of Finlay and William Regal and Queen Charmel. But yes, that is my number five, is Booker T as G.I. Bro. Rob, I know you were on the crew during most of that launch. What do you think about that, or was he on your list at all?
He was actually not on my list. I'm not gonna even remotely try to defend the Kane, you know, working as a I'm not gonna say he was working as a slave. He was just a gentleman who was accompanied by another gentleman who happened to be a white guy who told him what to do and kept his freedom at bay. But when he was the G.I. Bro character, the G.I. Bro character, honestly, not the worst concept to give him. He's a charismatic guy. He's a guy that can get the crowd fired up. And there's been a number of people who've tried to steal that Sergeant Slaughter gimmick of being, you know, the all-American soldier guy. He's someone that really could have carried that if he had the chance. To me, my first memories of Booker T was seeing him in GWF when he was Harlem Heat before they went to WCW. And they were already a pretty, you know, fully formed unit. But the G.I. Bro character could have worked, and it failed twice. And it takes a really special, terrible gimmick to be brought back and fail twice.
Well, it didn't help as well as throwing Master P in as your mouthpiece or manager for the second go around. I don't think that wrestling fans were too receptive to that. But Justin, what do you think of Booker T as number five? considering five-time world champion, six-time.
but when I knew Booker T was being inducted to the Hall of Fame this year, and I was going to see, I wanted to look back on some of his stuff. Didn't even know about the whole Chains thing. So the first time I saw that, when I was looking up his Hall of Fame stuff, and I was just, oh my God, I cannot believe what I was just seeing. I was just, I guess maybe it was the whole Southern aspect of WCW popping out there. But yeah, again, just another story of a guy persevering pretty much through his whole wrestling career, finally getting to the top. Like Rob said, he's a guy that always had showed that he has charisma from his time with Harlem Heat on. So the G.I. Bro character may have worked again, but, you know, it's just one of those things that you should never try something that's failed already once. So.
And not just failed already, but that wasn't really... it could have been a good idea, but... I mean, it was part of the No Limit Soldiers and the face paint and everything else. I don't understand what any sort of logic went into to bringing that back. But, Cam, what do you have to add?
Just that it was WCW logic. That's a whole other podcast.
Okay, well then let's move on. Let's move on to your number five. Considering you had very little to say about Booker.
Booker T was actually on my honorable mentions, but my number five is Diamond Dallas Page. Before he was a manager in the AWA, he actually tried to wrestle for the AWA, and what I saw, I couldn't find any matches, but what I found on the internet is it said that he had poor training and that he had such bad knees that they forced him to stop wrestling and they got him into managing. So I think that's kind of a funny debut, that someone to tell you that you're not worth the crap and eventually you're going to be a world champion.
Well, I actually had Diamond Dallas Page on my list as well. From what I know and listening to random interviews he's done, when they found him in a nightclub, running his nightclub, he always said he wanted to be a wrestler, but he was too old for it. So they brought him in to be the manager of the Fabulous Freebirds. Now, bringing somebody in to be a manager is one thing. Bringing somebody in to talk for Michael Hayes and for the Freebirds, that just seems stupid. And this guy is going to eventually turn that around and become a world champion. It's in at his age where it was, I think he was 43 or something like that when he won his first WCW championship. Again, it was during a time in WCW where it wasn't too big of an accomplishment to win the WCW championship. But he still does have world champion on his resume. He's looked at more, I think, as being a United States champion, as being one of the three guys that was never in the NWO. His feud with Macho Man Randy Savage during Monday Night Nitro's heyday is considered one of the greatest feuds during that time period. I think he's going to be remembered more for that than he's ever going to be remembered for his WCW title reign. I don't think he really wants people to remember him for his title reign, considering he kind of won it from David Arquette. Maybe he wants to move away from that and kind of focus more on the fact that he feuded with Macho Man and had the whole NWO thing going on. But yeah, he's a guy who started out, he started out as a manager. He had aspirations of wrestling, but he never really considered it to be realistic, and was able to pull it off and pull it off pretty successfully. Rob, what do you have to add?
I think he drives a hell of a pink Cadillac. I think that was one of his higher attributes. Diamond Dallas Page was a guy that I always had a problem buying as a world champion. And it wasn't just because of the weird Band-Aid he always had on his pectoral muscle. All the time. The fact that he initially started and they said, yeah, you probably shouldn't wrestle, doesn't necessarily make it one of the worst debuts. If anything, it makes it an inspirational story. He's more of an inspiration than the fact that he ever landed Kimberly Page. That, I think, is his true legacy. But he's a guy who he basically was the exact same character no matter what situation he was in. He was the weird-looking, kind of slimy guy who was probably going to be smoking a cigar, wearing a stupid vest, and was smart enough to buddy up with Eric Bischoff and get a cup of coffee with the world title. But didn't make my list because, honestly, to your point, Matt, I don't really consider him a truly memorable or impactful world champion.
Now, I have a question. This guy's work ethic, and, I mean, would you say, before I get into my actual question, would you say that he'll eventually be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame?
Yeah.
Okay. So you have him at that level, at least, that he was a hard enough worker and he was over enough during a very hot time period for wrestling that he made an impact on the history of the business.
No, I think he's going to make the Hall of Fame because I'm pretty sure that almost everyone at some point in time that had any kind of name whatsoever is going to make the Hall of Fame. And Diamond Dallas Page is going to live forever because, A, he got over the diamond cutter, which is not a hard move to get over, and B, he was in that Karl Malone match. So and the Jay Leno match. So for those reasons, he was a guy. He's a guy that will wind up being in compilations, DVDs, and highlight packages for years and years to come. And he's smart enough to always buddy up with the right people. I know they brought him back to host one of the DVDs. And if you're one of the guys they're willing to bring in to fly to Stanford and put you in the building and put you on a DVD, they're damn sure going to put you in the Hall of Fame.
And that kind of leads me to my original question for you was, if he had had this run, and I'm talking strictly not the Kimberly Page run and not the run against the Booty Man and Johnny B. Bad and all that, but if he had that working man run in the WWF right before the Attitude Era, where he was building up, say he came in around the same time as Steve Austin, and he had that same type of work ethic, he had that same type of politicking, he had that same charisma, because he does have a tremendous amount of charisma for a guy who really didn't know the wrestling business before he got into it. Do you think he would have been as successful as he was in the WWF with those circumstances?
No. I think to what you said, first, he had charisma, which means he would have automatically been somebody that Shawn Michaels would have made sure this guy doesn't get anywhere near the top. I think because of his age, and he's not necessarily a clean living guy, but he's a cleaner living guy than the way that most of that roster was in the 95 period. The second thing is one of the ways that he really got over was the diamond cutter. And he was able to have a million matches against a million people on that WCW roster. The WWF didn't carry that kind of roster where he could go out there and beat, you know, Jim Powers, and then he can go beat, you know, Steve Dahl or whoever the hell they're going to throw out there to really get over, hey, he's got an exciting move. They would only have him go out there against maybe four or five different guys, and he wouldn't get the squash match after squash match after squash match because they just didn't have that kind of a roster. So I don't think he would have really gotten the opportunity to get over in the WWF at that time. So he really benefited from WCW needing to fill, you know, 2 hours of Nitro plus WCW Saturday Night plus the Power Hour plus all their international programming, and they just had a ton of guys on their roster they could just let him beat.
Right. Justin, we didn't get your thoughts. What are your thoughts on DDP being Cam's number five?
Like you said, bringing somebody in to manage a team is one thing, like you said, but like obviously Michael Hayes is one of the better talkers to ever come along wrestling-wise, so that was probably not the smartest thing to do on WCW's part, but I kind of agree with you guys. I'll always remember him pretty much for a Randy Savage feud and then his feud with Raven also in WCW that took place. But, I mean, yeah, his debut, I mean, to be told that you can't wrestle because you're so bad and you have bad knees is pretty bad debut, I guess, if you want to kind of like that.
And let's go, let's jump right into your number five because you're next one up.
Yep. My number five is actually JBL, John Bradshaw Layfield. He had two different kind of debuts. I know he wrestled in the Global Wrestling Federation, but his more well-known debuts were with the WWE. He started off as Justin Hawk Bradshaw, and he had the gimmick where he quote-unquote branded his opponents with JB and Inc. And then he had, obviously, Uncle Zebekiah, who's now Zeb Coulter, as his manager, obviously better known as Dutch Mantel. And then after that character pretty much fizzled out and went away, he got re-debuted with Barry Windham as the new Blackjacks, trying to take off the original Blackjack tag team managed by Bobby Heenan. And then that just kind of fizzled out as Barry Windham got injured, and then he pretty much had nothing left for JBL until he finally re-debuted as the Acolytes of Farouk, and they finally got over. And then eventually, obviously, as we know, went on to have probably the most successful and his best gimmick in his career as John Bradshaw Layfield, the New York Wall Street industry tycoon, and actually ended up winning the WWE Championship. So JBL is my number five.
JBL was one of the guys that I had near the bottom of my list, and that just means he was one of the last guys I thought of. And like you said, it was And that one was tougher for me simply because Justin Hawk Bradshaw wasn't necessarily a bad gimmick for that time period. I mean, everybody kind of had a bad gimmick at that time period. It was the time of Savio Vega and the Godwins, and pretty much everybody was bad. And he was just a rough and tough cowboy, and he was a bad guy. So okay, that's not great. It's not great. It's not awful. But then the rebranding of him as being Blackjack Bradshaw just sealed the deal for me. And also the fact that he reinvented himself so drastically to actually end up being WWE champion, I think really is what cemented him as being somebody that could be included onto this list. Because if he had even looked similar to what had made successful as being part of the Acolytes or the APA, you really couldn't include him into this list. But because he completely did a 180 on his character, his career also did a 180, and all of a sudden here is this guy who is a main eventer in the twilight of his career. It was a guy who wasn't supposed to succeed as well as he did at the time of in his career that he did. People all pretty much gave up on him. He was pretty much retired. Nobody really cared about what he was doing. And he went out and capitalized on what he saw as being a hole in the roster and really ran with it. Cam, you have anything to add to JBL?
He's one of those guys that if we were doing like a top 10, he would be on there. I think I agree with everything, but I think he had a great run as a WWE champion against John Cena and Randy Orton and stuff like that, but I think his best work was like the APA with him and Ron Simmons. I thought that work was just the best of his career.
Wow, you thought that his work then was better than his work with Eddie Guerrero as WWE champion?
Well, maybe not necessarily that feud, but I didn't really like his stuff with John Cena.
Okay. Well, I mean, it was kind of hard to like anything that John Cena. I mean, that was early in John Cena's career, but he was still kind of getting a little stale at that point. Rob, what do you have to say about JBL besides him being a fantastic commentator that we always had to bleep out?
Exactly. JBL wasn't on my list. Wasn't even I guess a contender because the Justin Hawk Bradshaw character was a great character. At that point in time, a lot of people were given just the worst gimmicks ever, including a couple that are on my list. But his character was basically the traditional Stan Hansen kind of, I'm going to wear a cowboy hat and I'm a rough, tough, redneck guy and I'm going to go beat the hell out of you. And he looked like the kind of guy that would be able to do that. The fact that the gimmick didn't really take off was just sort of a commentary on the way that the whole company was at that point. But if JBL was that character, I'd say 10 years earlier, he would be doing house shows with Hulk Hogan because he would have been playing that Terry Funk kind of wild, crazy, you know, brawling Texas cowboy hat guy that Vince loved to throw out there. So I don't think the gimmick was necessarily bad. I just think the timing of it didn't really work. And the Blackjacks could have worked, but, you know, Barry Windham's injury was what it was. And it was kind of a tragedy, but I don't know if I would necessarily say it's one of, you know, the worst ever, but I guess maybe I'm just sort of oddly nostalgic for that really bad time period of WWF.
Yeah. You kind of had the same argument I had it and going back and forth on it. And like I said, I didn't think that the Hawk gimmick was bad. Like you said, it was very much Stan Hansen, Bruiser Brody style. I'm just going to walk into the ring, kick the crap out of you, and leave you laying. But like I said, the Blackjack one just kind of pushed it over the edge for me, where I was able to lump him into the group, but he was far down on my list. But I can totally understand Justin putting him on the list. Cam, let's go over to you for your number four.
My number four is actually Colt Cabana. I want to say that him and Adam Eaton really brought back the NWA title, so I thought I could include him on this list. I want to go with his WWE debut as Scotty Goldman. I think when they signed him, they signed guys, especially that time, those couple of years when they were just signing every hot indie prospect. It was like they didn't even watch tape on Colt Cabana. They gave him this horrible gimmick, not even really even a character, just a guy, and would just go job on putting that heat. And I think it was just the worst thing they did, especially when they released him and basically blamed it on him.
Interesting choice, simply because the NWA title isn't considered what it was. I think that's why Colt Cabana didn't even cross my mind when looking at this list. I don't look at the NWA title right now as being a world championship. I know it's starting to gain prestige back very, 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 very slowly, and it is defended around the world, so it is a world championship, but I don't know. It's in that time period right now where it could go one way or another, and I don't know. That one seems like a very borderline call for me. Rob, do you have anything to add to that?
As a company man for the WWE, I ignore your history of the NWA title. It's my understanding the NWA title merged with the WCW title, which became the World Heavyweight title held by Triple H, which is currently being defended now. Therefore, any other NWA title is completely phony. But I will say, Scotty Goldman was basically just Colt Cabana, but he just was never given a shot. I know, Matt, you know, that they were working on the web series that he did.
Yep.
The Scotty Goldman questions. That's
yep.
the kind of thing that maybe 2 or 3 years later would have really gotten him over. And he
yeah,
was
he'd
really
be Zack Ryder.
Victim of timing.
Yeah.
He's better than Zack Ryder. I'm a
right,
big
but he would have nitpicked Zack Ryder's fans before Zack Ryder could get to him, essentially.
I think he would have gotten that, and I think the fact that CM Punk would have continued to get more and more power would have definitely helped him there. But
yep.
the Scotty Goldman gimmick was a victim of literally given no time whatsoever and not letting him do the one thing that makes him Colt Cabana.
Right. And it's interesting, I remember listening to, I think it was his podcast, but him just talking about wrestling in front of Jim Ross or wrestling in front of, I think it was Dusty Rhodes, or no, it was in front of Ted DiBiase. Just having one of his comedy matches and doing what Colt Cabana does and what's made him popular. And if anybody out there gets a chance to go to your local high school gym or wherever there's going to be a little indie show and Cabana's going to be on the show, go, because it's not going to be a serious, intense match unless he's wrestling Adam Pearce for the NWA title. But it's gonna be fun. He's gonna be able to showcase chain wrestling, and it's gonna be entertaining. It's what it is missing from WWE, TNA, and ROH TV right now, because he is one of the very few guys in the North American wrestling scene that can wrestle at like he does. And I remember him Ted DiBiase saying, he's like, this is what's missing from television right now. It's just fun. It's somebody that's out there who's not doing the tons of fun gimmick where it's just like cheesy fun. Or even like Santino, who has like spurts of funny moments and things like that. But once you get into the match and stuff, there's only different spots that he does that are funny. Colt Cabana can put on a serious match while also throwing in certain things here and there that really entertain you and can make you laugh out loud while also taking the match seriously. Having him, like I said before, having him on this list is a little dicey for me simply because of when he held the NWA Championship. But besides that, he was obviously he's a wrestler that the WWE just never really gave a shot to. I don't think he should ever go back to the company as a wrestler. In my personal opinion, I don't think he'll ever get the showcase he deserves as a wrestler. He's doing perfectly fine on his own. So if you ever get a chance to go out and see him, go out and see him, because I don't think you're going to see him on TV anytime soon. Justin, do you have anything to add at number four?
I think Colt Cabana, like you said, was one of those guys where if he was trying to get his first come around in the WWE when CM Punk is kind of where he is right now, it might have worked out a little better for him. But I think if he came back right now, he'd be way too restricted. And I think you're taking a risk that it could be like a one-time thing where it works for 2 or 3 months and he's over, and the fans kind of just quickly losing interest with him, because they got to remember not all the WWE fans are people like us who know who Colt Cabana is and know all the funny things he does in his podcast. So it'd be something where, I think if CM Punk, if he came back right now for his first time when CM Punk is like near the top of the company, has a lot more say, I think he'd have a shot. But yeah, I agree, I wouldn't want to see him back in the WWE in any shape or form.
And what do you think of him being on a list like this, and as far as where he won the title in his career?
I think it's kind of a stretch. I mean, yes, the NWA title's getting a little bit more prestige right now, but I guess I would have to agree it's a little bit of a stretch. I don't think it's to where, obviously, where it used to be.
I'm getting buried this week, Daryl.
Yeah, you're at number four though. Give Justin time. I'm sure he'll come up with something. But let's go before we go to Justin's number four. Let's go over to Rob's. Rob, what's your number four on your list?
Well, I didn't do mine based on a hierarchy. So my number four was just the next one on my list. Was I'm sure on every person's list here, and that's got to be Kane.
Kane's, and which debut are you going with?
he's another one like Ziggler, who's a two-time loser.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that Kane winds up on this list more than anything else is you look at a guy like that with that kind of size and that kind of physique and that kind of a unique look, and the fact that Vince McMahon said you're going to be a dentist shows that they had literally no faith in him being a major player. That, to me, makes it one of the worst debuts, because from day one, he was Jerry Lawler's lackey dentist coming off of that awful Kiss My Foot match with Bret Hart, and there was no way that a dentist was going to become the WWE champion. So he was saddled with a losing gimmick from the beginning. His second loser gimmick I happen to love, just because I'm an attorney and any time it involves any kind of law makes me happy, was when he was Vin Diesel. It all came down to the lawsuit between the WWF and the WCW over Scott Hall and Kevin Nash appearing on TV and Vince saying, hey, they're portraying Razor Ramon and Diesel and those are our characters. And then when the court kind of stopped laughing at him, Vince goes, you know what? I have Razor Ramon, I have Diesel, and I'm going to treat it just like Boink the Clown, and I can put anybody in that gimmick, and they're going to get over. So they stuck poor Glenn in that role as fake Diesel, with Jim Ross, of all people, as his mouthpiece. And Jim Ross was the only guy that, in the entire company, that the fans will never accept as a heel. He's folksy. People like him. People trust him. They don't want to boo Jim Ross. So that gimmick was DOA and essentially only existed for the purpose of a lawsuit. Thankfully, the stupid Kane gimmick that they originally were going to go with, wound up working out. He had a tremendous debut, and because they were so worried about how limited he was in the ring, they're like, we're not going to let you wrestle. We're just going to have you go out there and just chokeslam people like you're 9-1-1. And it worked. So for that reason, he had just two death gimmicks in a row, and Kane, by the grace of God, got over, and he became a world champion and is probably going to be, once Taker hangs it up, the oldest guy around the roster.
Yeah, what I found funny too about his debut and the fact that he was brought in by Lawler, coming off of being the USWA heavyweight champion, and Lawler was like, hey, I have this massive guy who can play as my surrogate against Hart and put on a competitive match with Bret Hart. And they decided to make him a dentist. And it was one of those, like, you're just sitting there and you're like, okay, he's a dentist. And you didn't expect anything out of him. You didn't really look forward to the match at all. I remember the match coming out. I believe it was SummerSlam, I want to say. It was SummerSlam. And what I specifically remember is him pulling off a top rope leg drop across Hart, who is leaning over the top rope, and they did a whole throat-crushing angle there. But here's a guy who's nearly 7 feet tall, can jump off of the top rope, has enough agility to turn his body enough to hit a leg drop onto a guy safely, and you make him a dentist, and a dentist with bad teeth. It blew my mind, and obviously he was high up on my list that I wrote down simply for that gimmick and for Fake Diesel. I thought they were going to go with Fake Diesel a little bit longer than they did, considering he was in the Final Four of the Royal Rumble at one point. But thank God they did it, simply because they did transition into Kane, which was a fantastic debut, and the way that the character has played out over the years. He's really made it his own. He's really been able to establish a legacy for himself, and obviously a Hall of Fame career. And the way that the character has evolved over the years, is it as drastic as The Undertaker has evolved his character? But it's changed enough that he's been able to play a mid-card role strongly throughout his entire career. Justin, what do you have to add to that one?
Yeah, he's one of the ones that I try not to include too many obvious ones on my list, so he's one of the ones I left off. But I don't know, I think that Dr. Isaac Yacom did his job, because he made 6-year-old Justin absolutely terrified to go to the dentist at that time. So as far as that goes, I think he did a good job of doing that. But yeah, when you look back on that, it's just one of those really bad gimmicks. And the whole thing, the only thing I liked out of those things were, even though they weren't involved in them, it led to that Huckster and Nacho Man skits during that whole time period. But yeah, definitely two bad things. And like you said, it's nice to see him finally take a character and have it last as long as he did in the Kane character.
Yeah. And Cam?
Hey, I think Yankum was actually my number one on my honorable mentions. Yeah, I thought it was just like a horrible idea, and it's just something like Rob said, they just didn't have any faith with him, and they just stuck him out there. And everyone else said that he just stuck it out long enough to have a strong career, and he's going to be a Hall of Famer one day.
All right, and let's move over to, I think we're on, Justin, you're number four.
Yeah, my number four is The Rock. I mean, we all know how he debuted. I think when you have a wrestler who looks back on his own debut and makes fun of it half the time when he does promos, it's a bad one. He came out as Rocky Maivia, the good, clean-cut babyface, having streamers coming down from his outfit that he had on. And I think the reason it makes my list is because they were trying to get him over as his clean-cut, third-generation, good guy babyface. But you could already tell at that time period in the WWE that it wasn't full-blown Attitude Era yet, obviously, but it was starting to change with the introduction of Stone Cold Steve Austin. And I just, and even Shawn Michaels at the time was not super edgy, but he was kind of getting there. And those two guys were over with the crowd. The crowd was liking Steve Austin's, you know, kind of like take no names, you know, do whatever he does gimmick. And Shawn Michaels was obviously over for being him. And then they tried to introduce The Rock as this clean-cut, good guy character in front of, like, at the time, it was a New York City crowd. I mean, crowds like that weren't that bad as they are nowadays, but a New York City crowd can be tough. I just think it was a bad debut for the time that it was, because it seemed like it was starting to slowly shift into the more hardcore Attitude Era-like characters with Steve Austin and Shawn Michaels, and they were trying to get this clean-cut Rocky Maivia character over, and it just never ended up working. And within months, the crowd was chanting, "Die, Rocky, die," at him.
I'm a little bit surprised at this choice, simply because it appeared to me like this wasn't so much a character, because it really did feel like it was just Dwayne Johnson trying to be a good guy wrestler. I didn't really see any character going on with it. Yes, pineapple haircut and weird dreamy entrance gear is horrible, but that wasn't really the character. The character was just the fact that he was just generic babyface. That's all there was. There wasn't really too much going on character-wise. So I wouldn't really put him on a list for me simply because what he debuted as wasn't what made him a legend. But it wasn't a bad debut. I mean, he went out there. I mean, he wiped the floor with the Survivor Series team. He was the sole survivor, went on to be IC champion, and then was able to transition himself into The Rock and being a heel once he recognized that this wasn't what the crowd wanted. So it wasn't as if he was saddled with a horrible gimmick. It was just the fact that the crowd was changing and he decided to change with it. He actually put on more of a character when he changed into the heel Rock character than he was when he was Rocky Maivia. Rob, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, you know, I think that the Rocky Maivia character is who he plays right now. This kind of phony, smiling babyface guy, which is always Vince's default character. All he wants is a smiling, happy babyface. It's, you know, what they got with Backlund, it's what they got with Hogan. When they tried to bring Randy Orton in as a third generation star, they just wanted him going out there as a guy smiling and happy. And the Attitude Era kind of caught up to The Rock. But if they were to bring that kind of character now, with the slightly watered down WWE atmosphere, it would probably be fairly successful. He himself has shown that when he goes into this phony, over the top, happy, really, really humble, when you see him doing these interviews for his movies or his TV show or whatever it may be, I mean, as wrestling fans, we know deep down who this guy can be. And that this guy can be filthy and vulgar and cocky and obnoxious, but he can play this fake, smiling, super shiny baby face that, unfortunately, for the very brief window of time that he played that character, it was never going to get over.
Yeah, I that might play into to why I couldn't really see this as being, because I do see, like how you said, it's like it feels more like Rocky Maivia is Dwayne Johnson compared to The Rock is not. The Rock is the character compared it, if you understand what I'm saying. Kim, what do you have to add to it?
Yeah, I think I completely agree with you just on that. I think it wasn't necessarily a bad debut, just kind of like bad timing, and I think he is like The Rock is like the badass type guy that we all know from the Attitude Era and the SmackDown Hotel and all that stuff. And I think that he just playing that cheesy babyface, especially this time, had I guess fans like us kind of up in arms because we just didn't want that. And it was just really boring, especially when John Cena is portraying the same character.
All right, so there's Justin's first dud of the week. I mean, we always have a top five. It wasn't as bad. It wasn't as bad as the Dominator episode. But
no, it was not.
It is still only number four. So we still have time. We still have time to go. So I'm curious to see what's going on here. But that being said, I'll give you my number four. I think I'm the next one up. Yeah. My number four, I'm going to go with Raven as Scotty Flamingo in WCW. We included in our world champions ECW during their prime. Raven was the ECW world champion numerous times and probably their most famous world champion besides maybe Shane Douglas. And he was also the NWA world champion before TNA really made it NWA TNA. It was just the NWA world heavyweight champion. Obviously, the ECW championship stands out a little bit more. This is a guy who debuted as Scotty Flamingo in WCW. He was a beach bum who wore pink and black sunglasses, pink and black tights. I still remember him having a fantastic match with Brian Pillman at one of the Bash's beaches very early on. I believe it was in 91 or 92. Then took Scotty Flamingo to WWF and transitioned into Johnny Polo and as a manager. Essentially the same smiling, cheesy, wanna slap babyface, or not babyface, heel, cocky heel character. But still kind of the same guy. It was this guy who was a very loudmouth, very abrasive. You just didn't really like him. And he was just kind of over the top, cocky heel. And then all of a sudden, he appears in ECW, and ECW just transforms into Extreme Championship Wrestling from Eastern Championship Wrestling, and now it's Eddie Vedder on steroids and harder drugs and more depressing a life and larger vocabulary, and God knows what else the hell was going on in his head, but if you look at videos and you look at pictures side by side, you would not think that these two guys were the same person. And he was able to completely reinvent himself into probably one of the most influential wrestlers of the 90s as Raven, and going on to have very memorable feuds in ECW, and then eventually parlaying that into a semi-successful career in WCW with his matches, like you mentioned earlier, Justin, before, with his matches with DDP and having his flock around him. Another one of the few guys who stayed away from the whole NWO thing, left WCW before the NWO thing kind of took over the entire company, and then transitioned into the WWE and was hardcore champion numerous times, was a mainstay on TV as just kind of the guy that was always out there. You always knew who he was. And then was the very, very early days of TNA and was in part of those weekly pay-per-views where they were starting to make a name for themselves as being this small indie promotion in Tennessee that was really standing out with his matches with AJ Styles and with Jeff Jarrett and these bloody feuds that would take place on pay-per-view that you would be reading about and just have to go back and try to find online during the very birth of the digital age and being able to watch wrestling on your computer. But yeah, Raven was a type of guy who, like I said, if you look at photos and you watch videos from Scotty Flamingo or Johnny Polo and then look at photos and video of Raven, it does not seem like the same person. Rob, what do you think of that one?
I am a huge Johnny Polo mark. So I unfortunately, I'm dead serious. Scotty Flamingo and Johnny Polo, big, big fan. Scotty Flamingo, I remember watching in the GWF, which was great because it used to air on your network, ESPN. So it was a great way to introduce him. But the Johnny Polo character was absolutely fantastic. And it was something that he was really able to tap into, is that smarmy, obnoxious heel. And he played it better than, I'll go back to burying him again, he plays it better than a Brad Maddox. And that's the kind of guy that Brad needs to be. Get under your, you just like bamboo shoots under your fingernails. I still vividly remember watching him as the manager of the Quebecers singing the Mountie theme song.
Mm-hmm.
Just so obnoxious, twirling the polo mallet. He played that character, you know, to a T. And, you know, really showed that he wasn't, you know, Raven. He wasn't a guy who really lived his gimmick initially. I think eventually the Raven gimmick kind of swallowed him whole and, you know, turned him into a guy who battled all these demons with drugs and all these other issues. But I don't necessarily think it was one of the worst debuts of all time. I just think it was somebody who played that character really well, kind of like JBL, who could jump from skin to skin to skin.
But for me, it was like, did you ever picture Johnny Polo or Scotty Flamingo as being a world champion?
No, but at the same time, if it wasn't for ECW, I don't think Raven would have been a world champion if he was in WCW or in the WWE. And when he was, you know, NWA champion or NWA TNA champion, however they were hyphenating at that point in time, part of it was that nostalgia kick of the only guys who got to hold that title were people that you knew from other companies. So that's why it went to, you know, a Jeff Jarrett, or they were able to put it on Raven, because, hey, let's hope we're going to pull in some of those ECW fans who are willing to plunk down $10 for the weekly pay-per-view, and we're going to pop it by using his name. So I don't think he was going to ever be, you know, WWF champion as Johnny Polo, but I don't think he would have ever been WWF or WCW champion as Raven.
Okay, fair enough. Justin.
Yeah, it's amazing to see somebody like start off like a Johnny Polo or a Scotty Flamingo and transition into a character like Raven like he did. I mean, I remember watching as a kid some of those Johnny Polo gimmicks, and it's one of those guys that even as a young kid, he always got underneath my skin because he always seemed like he felt like he was better than you, and he did a good job of doing that and making me want to hate him. But it's one of those things where when you give a guy like that, like Scott Levy, who has a good mind, can talk, and you give him Paul Heyman, and it ends up working. So it was one of those places where it was kind of the right place, right time, where he ended up in ECW with Heyman to pretty much launch his career.
Yeah, and Cam?
I think Raven's one of those guys in the wrestling world that just knows what works, and he knows that the little things, and he knows, like you mentioned, the twirling of the polo stick and stuff. He knows the little things and what comes off well on television. I think he did that his whole career despite all of his different characters.
Yeah. And like I said, for me, I never said he was bad as Johnny Polo or Scotty Flamingo. I never pictured him as ever being a world champion anywhere. And the fact that he was able to pull that 180 and totally reinvent himself, and like Justin, like you said, he was right place, right time as being in ECW at that time with Paul Heyman and pulling that character out of him. Really launched him into I think our memories as he. I mean, he'll always be Raven. I don't think we really can look back at his career and think of as much as we like to go back and think of the early 90s and mid 90s of WWF. But he's not going to be remembered as Johnny Polo. He's going to be remembered as Raven. I disagree a little bit. I think if Raven was introduced in the Attitude Era, had the same formula and the same thing behind him, I think he was edgy enough and he's a strong enough mind that he could have made that work in the Attitude Era and been as successful. But there's a lot of other factors going around in the WWF, especially at that time. So God knows what would have happened if he could have just been swallowed whole by that machine and never could have seen the light of day. That was my number four. Let's move down to number three. Let's just go right over to you, Rob, for your number three.
My number three, I'm again going to kind of assume this guy probably made everybody's list, is Master Blaster Steel, Mr. Kevin Nash. Kevin Nash is another guy who has the dubious distinction of having three unbelievably terrible gimmicks in a row. A certifiable first ballot Hall of Famer for terrible debuts for a future champion. Nash started off as Master Blaster Steel, which Ole Anderson decided to rip off from the Road Warrior movie because they hadn't already, you know, bled that dry with Hawk and Animal, and basically just took this big, giant, 7 foot one guy, shaved his head down to a mohawk that was dyed red, and threw him out there as a monster who didn't talk. And anyone that has seen Kevin Nash knows his best attribute is the fact that he can actually kind of talk you into the building a little bit. He has the microphone skills above and beyond the fact that he's just this big monster. He then got the Oz gimmick, which it's funny because I remember hearing about it years ago before YouTube and before there was really the internet, and just couldn't fathom that that was something that really ever happened. Like, it was like everyone just had a collective fever dream, and it was like, it was just this running joke. Basically, Kevin Nash was dressed in all green. They put an old man mask on him to look like the wizard from The Wizard of Oz, and it was the kind of gimmick that appeals to no one. Kids weren't going to buy into it because it was absolutely terrifying looking. And adults weren't going to buy it because when he took off the mask and he had this dyed gray hair and this green outfit, he looked like a giant version of Hornswoggle. And nothing about that said, yeah, this guy's going to get the WCW title. And then he was Vinny Vegas, which was basically, I guess, Diamond Dallas Page, but without being Diamond Dallas Page. And Nash always said that was kind of the closest gimmick that he was allowed to be to himself. But he was a guy who came out with a deck of playing cards. There wasn't a lot more real meat to that. Vince
and suspenders
saw him. Oh yeah, and the suspenders. He had the suspenders with Oz too. He always had the suspenders. Somehow Vince McMahon saw this guy, and in his debut, he made more of an impact than in all the years he was in WCW. They put him out there as Diesel. They put him as Shawn's bodyguard. And Nash told the story in one of the podcasts or interviews he's done, where he said he basically put his notice in. And then a week later was on TV as Shawn's bodyguard. And that character transcended and made him a champion. And the fact that he overcame three of the worst gimmicks of all time is almost a testament to Nash's abilities. So for that reason, I mean, he has to have a permanent chiseled in stone place on the worst debuts of a future champion of all time.
Yeah, this was the one I was talking about, Justin. I don't think you could get much worse than Kevin Nash's first couple years in the business. Maybe one of the few people of my age bracket that and of where I live in the Northeast that remembers the debut of Oz. And absolutely being scared shitless because I had no idea what was going on and what the hell was happening. And then he took off the mask, and I'm just like, well, okay. And he was still coming down to the ring with midgets, and they had a fake yellow brick road with the lighting, and it just kind of baffled me. I was a fan of Vinny Vegas. I thought there was a real potential with him and the Diamond Stud, who turned out to be Razor Ramon. I thought putting those two together with Diamond Dallas Page as their manager could have had a great run as tag team champions. And they did. It just took about five more years and a complete career change and resurgence, and the fact that they had to leave WCW, become famous in the WWF, and then come back to WCW when they were already famous. Kevin Nash by far probably could be a number one or number two as far as worst debuts of a future world champion. And I consider his world championship being the WWF champion and not so much the WCW champion, considering the fact that he booked himself into the title. But Justin, what do you think of Rob's number three?
Yeah, I completely forgot about his first one as far as debut. I just remember him as Oz and Vinny Vegas. I can't believe I completely forgot about that first one. But, yeah, to see somebody, like you said, there's no one just book so badly and, you know, just come over to the WWE and I don't know. I mean, maybe it was a kind of situation, too, where he hung around with Shawn Michaels and made friends, and as that group rose together, he was finally able to get over. But, yeah, those are definitely three really bad gimmicks to be saddled with.
Yeah, and Cam, what do you think of Kevin Nash as either Oz, Vinnie Vegas, Master Blaster Steel, any of those fun triple threat there?
That Kevin Nash is actually my number one, and I was waiting for that for you to poke Justin's fun at that one. My number one is Oz gimmick. I thought just looking at WCW days, and I mean, non-world champions have had worse debuts in the WCW, but that just goes right there to show that's just one of the worst debuts, and that's my number one. Just something that Kevin Nash probably could not relate to at all, 0%, especially his first character where he wasn't allowed to talk or anything. Just they really missed the ball on that one for a while.
Yeah, like Rob, like you said before, I'm like, here's this 7-foot guy. I mean, At the time, I believe they still had Sid on the roster and Dan Spivey, and I know they went with the skyscraper gimmick at one point, and it's like, just think of the fact of putting Sid and Kevin Nash together before they were Sid and Kevin Nash, and think about what they could have accomplished, say, in the WWF as 2 7-foot-tall monsters and kind of plowing through everybody. Like, just the impact that could have had. And instead, WCW made him Oz. It's something that it just shows you how much influence executives have in wrestling, especially back in the WCW era when it was completely controlled by Turner, and the executives that ran WCW had absolutely no idea what a wrestling product was. Moving on, since that was your number one, Cam, I'm going to move on to my number three before I get over to Justin. This will be Justin's punishment for having a bad number four. Going on to my number three, I got a lot to choose from here. I don't want to step on somebody's toes because I know somebody's full list. You know what? I'll go in and stay around the same time period, but in the WWF and in the nostalgia of the WWF, and go with Double J, Jeff Jarrett. For me, yeah, he was successful as an Intercontinental Champion, but the JEFFJARETT wannabe country singer with my band tonight. I could not ever imagine seeing him as a world champion. Granted, it took him going to a fledgling WCW and then owning his own wrestling organization in order to become world champions, but he still accomplished that in his career. He also was the USWA world champion, or I think it was just heavyweight champion. I don't know if they were ever considered a world champion. But Jeff Jarrett was that same type of Scotty Polo heel where he got under your skin. But he was a one-trick pony. He was that gimmick. That's all he did. That's all he had going for him. They tried to reboot him a little bit later when they brought him back with Cornette. And he had that weird Techno Team 2000 music and came down with a different robe and was – I don't know what they were going for. I can't even explain it. But yeah, that Jeff Jarrett, it was the country singer Jeff Jarrett, I should say, the light-up jacket era Jeff Jarrett – I never expected to be a world champion. I thought he did pretty well in a very fledgling WCW for a guy his size. And even in TNA, for as much slack as he gets and for much crap that he gets, you have to think about where that company started and where it is today. He was a major part of a lot of that growth, and he was still in the center of a lot of that growth and bringing in, yes, he brought in Kurt Angle and Sting was there and a lot of other people, and AJ Styles built that company, but he was still at the center of it, and he was still having these main event matches that people were still paying for. I mean, there's the advertisers and different people were still buying into this company. So he was obviously doing something right in order to get over well enough and to be a world champion. Obviously, he owned TNA, so it's kind of hard to give him credit for that. But he did get over well enough in WCW during a time period where it was hard enough to be noticed with the roster that they had. But he had a few good matches with Booker T and with Diamond Dallas Page awful matches once Russo and Goldberg and everything else started getting involved. But for a brief time period, he had a very solid career. I'll throw it over to you, Justin, and see what you think of that one.
Jeff Jarrett was one of the ones that I just left off on this, but again, something that I thought somebody else would include. But yeah, that whole corny this whole thing and this whole singing with the Road Dog, it was one of those things where it was, like you said, it was a time period thing, kind of like probably my number three is too, one of those things where it fit the time period, but you look back at it, and if you never knew anything else about him, you said never would have thought he ended up being a world champion. I also agree with you, man. While I think Jeff Jarrett's a little overrated, I also think that he does get a little bit too much slack for his time in TNA. I think he did a decent enough job with the company, and like you said, it's somebody that people still want to see the heel that you hated and you wanted to see him get beaten. You wanted to see your guy, like your AJ Styles, get over and beat him. But yeah, definitely that whole Double J gimmick was just really, really bad.
Yeah, and Cam?
Yeah, I kind of agree with you, Justin. He's somebody that's overrated. I did kind of like his work as as his first character, Jeff Jarrett, especially when he was Intercontinental Champion. I thought those annoying heels kind of always worked for me. Like you said, Rob, how your Brad Maddox was trying to portray that, but he's just not quite there. Those kind of gimmicks kind of worked for me. I don't think it's necessarily a bad debut. I just think it's just something that he kind of just one of those guys that fell into a world title. And like you said, Matt, he kind of had a start to be a world champion.
Yeah, like I said, it wasn't something that was awful by any means, because he was an Intercontinental Champion, I think two-time Intercontinental Champion. But you look back on it, and it's bad, because that whole part of WWF's time was bad. I mean, it's awesome in my eyes, because I look back on that, and it's very nostalgic for me. But it wasn't a good gimmick by any means. Rob, what's your few cents on Double J?
I loved the original Jeff Jarrett country music gimmick. I think it goes to what you were talking about with the Wyatt family, that the pieces that they produced for introducing Jeff Jarrett, with having him, you know, holding up the gold record in one of the vignettes, one of them going to Nashville and going to the recording studio, even the music video they recorded for him were just, I mean, absolutely top notch. And he had so much heat coming off of that gimmick, and it was one of the few gimmicks in that really just stupid time period where when he came out with the two fingers out strut and the light up straps that he was wearing and those ridiculous glasses, I mean, people hated this guy and was probably a victim of a lot of politics, because yeah, Jeff Jarrett wasn't the most exciting guy in the ring, but he was a guy who could go. And he was a guy that, if he would have probably made the right friends at the right time, he could have wound up having a WWF title run, because they were pretty desperate. And his gimmick, you know, really got over. Unlike, you know, a Dean Douglas kind of character, or they had, you know, Duke Drosy and T.L. Hopper and even Isaac Yankem, where they just threw people with random careers and stuck them out there. The Jeff Jarrett character, I mean, legitimately had heat. And I don't think he ever really got that back. And I especially hate the WCW run with those stupid yellow tinted glasses and the spray painted gray guitars. I mean, that it's the kind of thing that, if that gimmick made him a world champion, then the cheesy country music singer definitely could have made him a world champion.
Yeah, exactly. And like we all said, I mean, a lot of it is nostalgia. A lot of it, I mean, I can still sing all the words to With My Baby Tonight. I will fully admit to that. But but no, I never, like you said, he had heat, but in that time period, and especially during I mean, just looking at the roster, the WWF roster at that time, I never saw him surpassing the IC title level. I mean, the world champion at the time was Diesel. The main event feuds were with him with Vader or with Sid and guys of that nature. And he was perpetually facing Razor Ramon, 1-2-3 Kid, guys of that nature. So I never really saw him advancing anything higher than that. The fact that he was able to achieve more than that, and it wasn't so much the gimmick in WCW, but the way that he was able to establish himself as not only a main eventer in his own company, but also he looks. He didn't only look like a main eventer. I think he was accepted as a main eventer with his run in TNA and the way that he was able to establish that company. And it could have been, it could be just pure power of suggestion and the fact that we only ever saw him in the main event of TNA. But I look at him as being somebody who is a main eventer. I loved his last feud with Kurt Angle, the very end of it, where he played the fake martial arts guy or mixed martial arts guy who wanted to upstage Kurt Angle. I thought that was hysterical. I just think that, like, I don't know if it's power, like I said, power suggestion, the fact that he's been in the main event of TNA for his entire run or whatever it is, but I never expected that the country singer from Nashville was going to be a world champion. And I thought that was a big jump for him to make. And that's why he made it onto my list. Moving on, who did we not get? We didn't get Cam, you're number three. We got your number one, we didn't get your number three.
My number three was Dolph Ziggler, his current wife, Caddy debut.
Oh, okay. So, so we got everybody's number three. Cam, what's going
on? No, you didn't get my number three.
Oh, we didn't get your number three? I was just skipping over you completely? Okay, let's go to your number three then.
My number three is almost pretty much similar to yours, Matt. It was one of those things where when you look back at it on the time and told me that he would have been a WWE champion down the road, I would laugh at you, and that was Triple H with his whole Connecticut Blue Blood gimmick that he had going on. I mean, he had the whole terrorizing thing in WCW, but he was, most people will remember him for this whole Connecticut Blue Blood thing. And kind of like we just said, like, I think in Triple H's case, there's one of those things where he made the right friends when he debuted. He was friends with, he became buddies with Shawn Michaels and Kevin Nash. And even after the whole Madison Square Garden thing, he became a pretty much a big jobber for a few months. And there's almost no hope for him, but he was one of those guys where he ended up paying his dues. And then he changed his gimmick as the eras changed from the Attitude Era and then upward. But when you look back on that Connecticut Blue Blood gimmick, I just thought it was a really bad concept. Like we said, it was one of those things where it fit the time period, but if you would have told me during that he would have been a WWE champion down the line, I would not have believed you.
I'm not going to say anything to that right now. I'm going to throw it right over to Rob.
Yeah, that gimmick was not a world champion gimmick, and I think that he was, much like Ziggler, a guy who was just thrown into a pre-made character. It goes to the whole idea of what Vince knows. Vince lives in Greenwich. Vince has a certain perception of what the people of Greenwich are like and decided, well, you know, God damn it, we should have somebody on TV making fun of my neighbors. And they just picked Triple H because he had long hair and he had the nose, and they thought this guy can come across as an aristocrat. And to finally see who he was, I mean, he was really playing against type. And that sort of lack of any, you know, authenticity would have worn thin, and he never would have really elevated himself trying to portray something that he absolutely was not.
And what about you, Kim?
Kind of did the same thing. It was something he wasn't trying to play, and it was a pre-made character for him. I don't think that's really another bad debut. I think it goes back to the snobby heel guys that I kind of tend to like if they do a good job with it.
For me, yeah. The reason why I gave a couple minutes for me to think about it a little bit, I liked Triple H when he was Jean-Paul Levesque in WCW. It was after Terror Rising. Terror Rising was terrible. When he was Jean-Paul Levesque and they had him pegged as being Steven Regal's protege, and they were going to launch the Blue Bloods tag team before he left and went to WWF, and they had to go with Earl Robert Eaton as William Regal's tag team partner, which is fantastic tag team, by the way. I was a fan of his work and the way that he was able to move around the ring, and it just seemed like he knew what he was doing, knew what he was going for, and knew what was asked of him. So when he showed up in WWF, I didn't have that gut reaction you did, Rob, of this being a Vince McMahon pre-made character. Looking back at it now and hearing interviews and stuff like that, obviously it fits that mold to a T. But he was essentially doing the same gimmick in WCW. So when he moved over to the WWF, I thought he was just doing the same gimmick as he was doing in WCW, something that got him over to an extent in WCW and parlayed it into the WWF career, and he elevated pretty quickly up the ladder in the IC title. And it took him to a certain point, and then he made the right friends, obviously, and was able to transition off of the Blue Blood into just the more snobby Hunter Hearst Helmsley until finally the obnoxious, degenerate Triple H, and then eventually the badass Triple H that we all know and that he'll be remembered for. I didn't really consider it a bad debut because I think I had that mindset. I didn't have the mindset of this was a guy that was just kind of throwing this gimmick. If you're looking at it, like, if you're looking at it, it's just him going through his career and the fact that he was kind of skyrocketed as the IC champion and then kind of took a nosedive again after that when he had to pay all the repercussions for the MSG incident. Yeah, it's a little surprising to see that he eventually made it back up to a world championship level. But his initial push and his run as, he got the rub off of Curt Hennig by beating Mark Marrow for the IC title and then went on to have a couple great matches as the IC champion and really start to run with that ball. I didn't have that initial gut reaction of this guy's not going to be going anywhere and this is going to be an awful character, and I don't see anything for him in the future. So that might be why that I have a little different opinion, why I wouldn't put him on a list for me. But I can see where the rest of you are coming from and not having seen him in WCW and thinking that this is just a Vince McMahon idea and here's another new pre-made character that we're just going to throw on somebody like Duke the Dumpster Drosky, which he ended up jobbing to at some point. But so that was your number three. So we're moving on to number twos. And let's go over to Cam. Cam, this will be your last one because you already gave us your number one. So what's your number two?
My number two, probably a couple people have it on their list as well. I couldn't really leave it out because I thought it was horrible. My number two is Stone Cold Steve Austin's debut in the WWE as ringmaster. I thought he had a horrible look. I think giving him a mouthpiece, even though Ted DiBiase is a great talker, I think it wasn't necessary. And I thought it was just a whole thing to miss until he came up with the Stone Cold Steve Austin gimmick.
I was curious to see if anybody brought up the ringmaster, mainly because I didn't think it was so bad of a gimmick. He always talks about the fact that he was brought in to be a hand. He was brought in to be a worker. He was brought in to put over other people. And the ringmaster was nothing. There is absolutely nothing going on. He had no character. He was basically just supposed to be the guy in the ring that can make other people look good. Yeah, that's terrible. But there was also, like I said, I mean, it's not really a gimmick. It was just him. I think that's why I left it off of my list. Giving him a mouthpiece was awful. He was fantastic as Stunning Steve Austin. I see no reason why he needed to be the ringmaster or it needed to have Ted DiBiase as a mouthpiece. It didn't make sense at all. Rob, do you have anything to add on to him?
To me, the character, it was an innocuous character. I didn't have a major problem with it, and I think that the way that they brought him in was he was the crown jewel of the million-dollar faction. And it's almost like what they're doing with Curtis Axel with Paul Heyman now. I'm not saying that all of a sudden, you know, Curtis Axel tomorrow is going to break out and be the next Steve Austin, but I think this notion that the ringmaster gimmick was a terrible gimmick and that it was, you know, he was holding down his career completely is more of a work and more of something that they want to build into the legend of the Steve Austin character. As the ringmaster, he was just, here's a really talented guy who's got a vindictive mean streak to him, and they needed somebody with some teeth to put with DiBiase because nobody else was really kind of working within that group. So I wouldn't necessarily put it as one of the five worst of all time. I don't think that Ringmaster was ever going to elevate him to being a world champion, but at the same time, I don't think anybody really viewed Steve Austin as the guy who was going to be, you know, a world champion.
Yeah, I had a very, that's pretty much what I was saying. It was very similar. Justin, what do you have to add to it?
I think it's one of those things where it was a good gimmick, but it was probably given to the wrong person because anybody who would have seen Steve Austin in ECW and WCW was knew that he was a guy that could talk and could hold his own on the microphone, and it always did a pretty good job in both promotions when he was there. So it was one of those things where the gimmick worked, but I think it was just given to the wrong person.
And not only the wrong person, like I said, it wasn't really a gimmick. Like Rob said, it was here is this guy who was brought in just to be a wrestler, and that's what he did, and it worked. I mean, eventually he had to break away from that, and he had to establish his own persona and be his own person. And that's where Stone Cold was brought out from that. But I don't think it was anything that – I don't think that the ringmaster really held him back. Like you said, Rob, it's kind of been built into the Steve Austin lore that he was able to break away from that character. But it wasn't really a character. It was just – it was him. It just wasn't him talking. Let's go on to your number two, Rob.
My number two is Deacon Batista. Batista was my world champion during a decent chunk of my tenure with the company. The reason that I put him on there, the reason I put him so high on there, is Batista is another guy like a Steve Austin or a Kevin Nash, who his strongest attributes were completely buried in the character he was given. This was back when they split the Dudley Boys, and I'm glad you're recording this because this is the only time I'm really going to ever praise TNA in my life. TNA found a way to get the Dudley Boys over as individuals by establishing Bully Ray as a world champion. Never thought I was really going to see it. It's one of the few things that I will say that they really did a hell of a lot better than WWE. When they split Bubba and Devon, and they made Devon the preacher character because Vince just loves to rip into religion, they decided that he was going to have a guy go out there holding a collection box to basically strong-arm people into giving donations. and they threw it onto Batista. It was a character that just had a blank expression. He was essentially clothed from head to toe, and shaved head, didn't talk, took away everything that made Batista, you know, who he ultimately was. Batista has a weird sort of charisma about him, and that character, which was an extension of his terrible OVW gimmick, just wasn't him. It was one of those massive misfires on Vince's part that they just miscast this guy from day one. He's a guy who has a tremendous physique that you really don't need to cover in a giant jumpsuit. On top of the fact, he's a guy that doesn't need you to stand there and be the strong, silent, you know, bodyguard or muscle or whatever he was. And, you know, thank goodness he was given a chance to kind of transcend that. But it was this really just goofy, terrible kind of character that if he didn't get away from that, he never would have gotten over, and he probably would have been released like all the other random giant monsters that never really pan out.
Yeah, I thought it was funny watching him, and even watching him at that point, it felt like he was just there to get D-Von over. And in most cases for a character like that, that person is there in order for the more established guy to help get the newer guy over. Look at Dolph Ziggler and Biggie Langston. I mean, you're looking at somebody who was what, 6'6", 6'7", about 320, or just jacked to the nines, and they had him. I think they had him at some point. They put him in a preacher's outfit with the arm sleeves cut off. But besides that, he was just, like you said, dressed head to toe in a preacher's outfit, holding a collection tin. And he would have, or D-Von would have him help win his matches by hitting him with a collection tin. And it was terrible. I mean, if you look back at pictures of Batista in OVW, it's this, I think it was Levitavin, or I forget what the name of the character. Leviathan character, and it was this demonic looking guy. He had weird contacts in and spiked teeth and a mohawk and whatever it was, and to see what he debuted on in SmackDown, it's mind-boggling. It's like, who really they really thought that was a good idea? And it's thank God that he was able to kind of break away and that the whole evolution thing panned out the way it did, or else we might never be talking about Batista, and he would be one of those guys who, once he was released, just kind of faded away and was considered like the Nathan Jones of another Nathan Jones of the WWE. Justin, you have anything to add?
No, I pretty much agree with what you guys said. Like you said, I was never a big fan of the whole Reverend D-Von gimmick as it was, and just adding the Deacon Batista to it, I just think made it even more less likable for me. So I was never a fan of it overall, but I'm glad to see that, like you said, the whole evolution thing started, because Batista grew so much as a character through the years, through Evolution, and the whole big face turn he had against Triple H was so well done, I thought. And then even going back on to what I thought was a pretty good last run as a heel in the company. So it was great to see him break out from that and not just get saddled with that gimmick and have that be the only thing he was ever known for.
Yeah, and we kind of lost Cam on here, so I'm going to just jump down to my number two. We already got Cam's top 10, so if we lose him for the rest of the show, we have his 10. But to move on to my number two anyway, just to capitalize on what we were just talking about a little bit, I'm actually going to say that my number two is Bully Ray. Going from the stuttering ECW of Bubba Ray Dudley into the absolute transformation of probably the best heel in the business. I don't think right now, I think he's been watered down a lot now, but when he was first transferring over into Bully Ray, he was arguably the very best heel in all of wrestling. And to go and look back at the time and look at stuttering Bubba in ECW and then going over to WWE where he stuttered for a little while and then he was just Bubba Dudley and part of the Dudley Boys and had a run as tag team champions numerous times, which was fine. They split him up. It failed completely, even though he showed minor success as a singles competitor, but they still paired him up with Spike Dudley. And then they just put them back together and just let them ride the wave of being a tag team for the rest of their WWE careers. TNA was the first ones to really say, okay, go out there, be yourself, be a bully, be a bad guy, and see what happens. And he really, really took the ball and ran with it, and has become probably one of the best best transformations, I would probably say, from best success stories of a guy from the WWE that went to TNA and was able to grow, change his character, and probably be having the best moments of his career right now in TNA. Rob, do you want to comment? Because I know you brought up TNA just before.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I mean, the original Bubba Ray does just think that anybody coming out of that Dudley group outside of Devon, who was sort of the guy that had a lot of the fire and the passion and was the centerpiece of it. I mean, Bubba was brought in as this just kind of simpleton character and was overly gimmicky and overly shticky and just didn't seem like, yeah, that guy's going to be a world champion. And he also had to overcome the fact that just from a physical standpoint, nobody ever really looked at him and said, that guy is going to be a world champion. And his best bet for years always seemed like it was going to be an ECW if he was ever going to be a singles champion, because that guy could generate heat from a crowd when he cut a promo. I mean, like something you probably have never seen before or would see again. And he had that latitude to use the vulgar language and to really try to incite these riots, but he never got the shot at a singles run in ECW. WWE sure as hell wasn't going to give it to him. And TNA, you know, took the shot, but, you know, he transformed his body but kept his gimmick, kept his shtick of, yeah, I'm a jerk, I'm a bully, and that's what I'm going to be. But the evolution of his character, that initial Bubba Ray character, was definitely one of the worst debuts ever for someone who was going to be a world champion.
Yeah, and I don't think that even Paul Heyman had aspirations of him ever being an ECW world champion, but luckily that he was able to stick around for as long as he did, because it seems like everything just clicked in the past 2 years or so. Justin?
Yeah, I agree. Like, I really like to think of the Dudley Boys as one of the greatest tag teams of all time. And then I would say they're probably up there. I don't think they're the greatest, but you put them in the top 10 list. But people forget that they started not as this cool group with Bubba Ray coming out and cutting the edgy promos, like Rob said. They started as, like you said, the bumbling idiots who were stuttering the whole time. And I completely agree by saying you would look at that and you never think you'd become a world champion. I mean, he did have a nice short singles run when the Dudley Boys did break up in the WWE, where he fought Triple H for the world title once. And he kind of got over a little bit there, but nothing ever really materialized from him. Like you said, it was nice to see him stick it out and go through it, and now showcasing, like you said, maybe some of the best stuff in his career in TNA.
Yeah, well, let's move on to, I think you're up next for your number two, so let's get yours out there.
Yeah, my number two is actually, I know lots of people remember Shane Douglas for his Dean Douglas gimmick that he had in the WWE, which was in and of itself kind of bad, but if you go back to WCW in the early 80s, early 90s, he had a tag team with Johnny Ace called the Dynamic Dudes. And they were basically made out to be these California skateboarding guys, and they had this from everything I saw, I looked it up on YouTube for all the gimmicks. I saw one particularly bad one with really horrible music, where they were out in the California skateboarding shop interacting with fans, buying some kind of like shirt or skateboarding gimmick stuff, but you never saw them skateboard, and it was just so horribly cheesy, and it was just, I thought, a really badly put together tag team. It didn't really last too long. They had a brief feud with Stanley and Bobby Eaton, the Midnight Express, but it was just such a corny team. And when you look back, you would have told me that somebody like that from Shane Douglas going from the dynamic feuds with Johnny Ace to Dean Douglas in the WWE, and then again, it was one of those situations where he was, Paul Heyman was there at the right time. He became, and I don't know, he was ECW champion, the quote-unquote original ECW champion when he threw down the NWA belt, but he really expanded his gimmick in the late 90s in ECW when he was there with and Bigelow and Paul Heyman, those guys. So I think Shane Douglas as the dynamic feud, whether you want to count the dynamic feud, which was the one I encountered, or Dean Douglas, is this really, really bad gimmick.
Yeah, the dynamic dudes made my honorable mention. You're not the only one that remembered him from there. Rob, what do you have to say about that one?
I think the dynamic dudes were what guys in their 50s thought kids would think was cool. we can throw them in some neon clothing and put some skateboards out there, and these guys have blonde hair, and it'll work. It was an awful, awful gimmick. That and the Dean Douglas gimmick was just spectacularly bad, because the Dean Douglas gimmick was coming on the heels of, he had won the ECW title, you know, the throwing down the belt and talking about the sport of professional wrestling and established himself as this really, you know, guy who cut really intense promos and seemed very real and very passionate. And then you have him out there in probably the worst outfit anyone has probably ever worn, outside of like a Max Moon, where he was in that really ridiculous gray like singlety thing with all the weird punctuation marks all over it. That's a guy that I never thought was going to be a world champion, and I never would have pegged that the guy pretending to be a Bart Simpson ripoff was really ever going to be handed the ball and run with it. So I definitely think it merits mentioning on the list.
Yeah, for me, it was one of those, like I said, he was on my honorable mentions. And for me, it's funny. It's like, I always think that a heel teacher would get over well in wrestling, and it's never worked. I've never seen that gimmick work. It didn't work for him. It didn't work for Matt Stryker. It's probably not worked in 100 other instances, and it just doesn't work. It just seems like it should be so natural. Rob, we got your number two, and I don't know if we got just we have Cam's number one. So let's go to your number one first, and then we'll move on to Justin's.
All right, my number one is Jeff Hardy. The reason I put him at number one is, you know, when you came up with the initial framework of, you know, worst debut for a guy who is going to become world champion. Jeff Hardy is, I mean, one of the few guys ever across any promotion from top to bottom that started as a job guy and became a world champion. And when he was first out there and him and Matt were just getting, you know, squashed week after week, there was no chance in hell this guy was ever going to be any kind of a world champion. I mean, even his world title reigns in the WWE always seemed kind of flukish, but he's one of the few people ever to come from that level of being a job guy, being a guy that's basically just an enhancement talent, and actually getting over. And it's something that goes to my initial point of, Vince never looked at that guy and said, you're going to be a future world champion. The reason that there's so many kind of not almost repeats on the list is, he is very protective of guys that he would ever put the title on. You know, John Cena debuted very strong in there with Kurt Angle. Randy Orton debuted very strong when he was out there. Angle himself debuted very, very strong. He protects a lot of his guys. And there are a lot of guys who got brought in as that young kind of tag team. You know, they did it with Bret Hart. They did it with Shawn Michaels. And they were never portrayed in the way that Jeff Hardy was. I mean, Jeff Hardy was a guy, no entrance, maybe got a chyron on the bottom, just squashed and beaten in 2 minutes over and over again for a fairly long period of time. It wasn't like it was one or two squash losses and then they were going to build him to something. He was just the guy they were throwing out there, like a Dwayne Gill or an Iron Mike Sharp or a Barry Horowitz, and somehow managed to transcend that and become a world champion. And for that reason, I mean, he's my number one, because you go from literally the lowest of the low on the totem pole to actually winning a world title.
Oh, Jeff Hardy is, I think Jeff Hardy is probably the luckiest job guy in him and his brother, simply because they became jobbers when jobbers were going out of style. And once they were parlaying their careers off of the job and WWE was kind of getting rid of all the enhancement talent, they realized that they had teams like Edge and Christian, and they had teams like the Dudleys weren't there yet, but the APA and things, and actual tag teams that needed people to make them look good. And they didn't want enhancement talent anymore. They wanted somebody that was on the staff and on the crew that they can put in the ring every single week and make people look good. It just so happened that when they got put in the ring with Edge and Christian, both teams looked really, really good. And that's what launched their career to the point where they were considered actual superstars instead of people who got pinned week after week. They lucked out. I fully believe that they lucked out into a WWE contract. They lucked out into a permanent role. And he was able to – another guy, I mean – despite all the crap that he's going through and went through and everything else, there's just something about him. It's that it factor. People wanted to watch him. They wanted to connect with him. They wanted to follow along with him and follow his career and cheer for him. There was never a way that he was going to be a heel in the WWE. People wanted to see him succeed. And when he did succeed, it was like people rode the wave with him. Like, they had watched him from when he was a jobber and when he was nothing, and they watched him win the World Heavyweight Champion or the WWE Championship. And he won it from Triple H. It wasn't like he just won it from a random transitional champion. Here's a true zero to hero story, and it was something that was never, ever supposed to happen. And it truly is amazing that he was able to pull that off. Justin, do you have something to add to Jeff?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Like you said, it was a time when Jobber was starting to leave the company, and just to see him go pretty much from this skinny little kid that was taking bumps for guys like Kane and ascend to what he did today. I mean, I was at the pay-per-view in Buffalo where he won the WWE title from Triple H in a triple threat match with him and Edge, and it was just, I started becoming a fan of him once he started giving him his singles push, so it was nice to see him finally get to the top. And I really think if he was a guy who kept his head on straight more and didn't have the problems that he did backstage, he could have been a huge megastar in the WWE. I mean, I think he had enough of a following. He had enough charisma. He was good enough in the ring where I think he could have gotten to a really high level had it not been for all the issues that he had, the drug problems backstage. I think that's something that Jeff might look back on in his career and realize he probably does right now, know that he dropped the ball kind of big time during that singles run.
Yeah, especially considering the matches he was having with CM Punk on his way out the door. They were really clicking into the right prime of his career, and it was bad timing all around. But going back to Rob real quick, for you were saying that no other jobber made it as high as he did, which is true. But I also had on my list Mikey Whipwreck, who won the ECW World Championship. So I will just throw that out there. He was not only a job guy, but he was a part of the ring crew before he even made it into the ring. So I will throw him out there. He was nowhere near the level Jeff Hardy made it, but he was a job guy. He did make it up there at some point. But I have two different people who are still left on my list that nobody's brought up yet. So I'm going to throw to Justin first for your number one and see if you picked one of the two that I have left.
No, actually, my number one, like I said earlier, he was up high on my list, was Dolph Ziggler. So, yeah, we spent some time before, like I said. Yeah, nothing much left to add about him that we already talked about. So, so let's go with you, Matt. Like I said, mine's Dolph Ziggler.
Okay, so I had two that are kind of surprising. The first one I will just throw out there. I think it will be pretty obvious that, and we could kind of blow by him because it's not really a horrible debut, because a lot of people only choose his WWE debut as being the debut, but I'm talking Mark Calloway, The Undertaker, debuting as Texas Red, or Mean Mark Callis, or whatever generic debut you want to give him before he debuted in the WWE or WWF. He was just this random guy who kind of showed up, kind of beat somebody here or there, and then left. There is no gimmick whatsoever for him, period. Just throwing that out there, that's not my number one. I'm throwing it out there because nobody really mentioned him, and it's a little surprising, but I understand why. A lot of people only picture The Undertaker's debut as being that Survivor Series debut. The one that I'm going to put as my number one, and the one that a lot of people, I'm surprised nobody mentioned, was he was WWE champion, and he headlined WrestleMania, and he retained at WrestleMania, and that's The Miz. The guy came in off of the real world, came in through a half-assed Tough Enough that wasn't really tough enough, became the host of SmackDown, which makes no sense whatsoever. All he did was throw to different matches. I still don't understand what the point of the host of SmackDown was. Then he hosted the Diva Search contest that held specifically on SmackDown, parlayed that into a somewhat gimmicky wrestler in ECW, into a tag team title run with John Morrison, into an Intercontinental and then US title runs, and then Money in the Bank, and then the WWE Championship. Mike, the Miz Mizanin, was never supposed to be in the WWE. This guy did MTV. That was it. He was in the real world. He was Real World Road Rules Challenge. He showed up on those shows, and that was supposed to be it. WWE brought him in as being, hey, this guy has a little bit of celebrity name, maybe we could throw him on this half-assed Tough Enough, and maybe it'll draw some of that MTV crowd that we want to bring in and have somebody watch SmackDown. And all of a sudden, he's the WWE champion, and he's headlined WrestleMania against John Cena with The Rock involved in the match, and walked away with the WWE championship. I don't see how there's any other story of a guy who is not supposed to be a world champion that ended up being a world champion. Rob, do you want to comment on him?
A couple things with The Miz. First, I think he's a guy who did not deserve the world title the way that they did it, and will probably go down when, you know, the ultimate top five list of five guys who didn't deserve the title, he'd probably be at number one. He probably didn't deserve to main event WrestleMania, and the fact that The Miz has main evented WrestleMania when a guy like CM Punk has never main evented WrestleMania speaks volumes. I think that he was inevitably going to be part of the company because he was a celebrity. He was not just a member of the real world. He was one of those five or six names of people that you always remember. He was almost at a Puck level in terms of a real-world celebrity who was known beyond just being on the show.
Well,
because
he was
fact
on every
about,
show.
Yes, but he was, because he was a media figure. He was a celebrity. It's the same way if Maria Menounos tomorrow decided she was going to be a full-time WWE diva, I mean, they would embrace that with open arms and put her on everything all the time, no matter how poor her skills are. The thing is that the way The Miz was supposed to debut, he was going to be a partner. He was going to be partners with Matt Capitelli, who had won the prior Tough Enough, and the two of them were going to have this sort of reality show gimmick before he was even part of that half-assed Tough Enough. So the idea was going to be one of the Tough Enough winners and one of the guys in the real world walking around as reality TV stars before a Johnny Fairplay ever had an opportunity to do it. And they were going to do all these wacky vignettes. Unfortunately, Matt Capitelli had the had brain tumor and was unable to ever really compete. But Vince loved the fact that he had a bona fide celebrity in The Miz. And it was one of those, I don't care how you do it, just put him on TV. But he was absolutely not ready to go in the ring, so they made him the host because there really wasn't that assistant GM capacity or anything like that. And they threw him out there. And the fact that he made it up to the WWE title level is incredibly impressive. But to be honest, I mean, his gimmick never really changed. He was just this obnoxious guy who thought he was the greatest thing ever. And that's still the character he is now, years later, except for the fact that he added the word really into his, you know, repertoire.
Yeah, which is essentially it. That's all he's done, except he kind of dropped that whole chick magnet idea. But, Justin, let's go throw it over to you about The Miz.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things when he won the WWE title, his character, right around the Money in the Bank time, his character was catching on, was getting over right at the right time, so it just happened to coincide with Money in the Bank when he won it. I think after he won the WWE title, it just went downhill from there. I mean, he had a feud with Randy Orton that wasn't that great, and he had a feud with Jerry Lawler and actually had a match with him in Elimination Chamber. And then he was, despite being a WWE champion, he was pretty much the third guy involved in that WrestleMania main event after John Cena and The Rock. I mean, that whole buildup had nothing to do with it. Like, Miz just basically came out here and there when John Cena wasn't talking about The Rock. But, yeah, to see a guy come from, like you said, I think if it was, it had to be his whole being on the real world thing that got Vince, like you said, Vince McMahon got his attention. He's like, oh, my gosh, there's some kind of celebrity that was on a TV show before us that wants to be on. And it's, you know, probably that and it's Tough Enough, which is, like you said, bad. And it's just one of those things where I completely agree where we look back on guys who are WWE champions, Miz will be barely a footnote in it, and people will probably even forget that he even made an event at a WrestleMania.
Yeah, and I fully agree with all your opinions on it and how he will be remembered, and unless he drastically changes his career and his perception among the wrestling community. But it's still the fact that our list was top five worst debuts of a future world champion, and I had to throw him on there. I mean, the guy was, he debuted on Tough Enough, but he debuted as the SmackDown host. It was even a wrestler. Like, it's a horrible, horrible, horrible way to debut. I mean, we never even expected him to be a wrestler, let alone the WWE champion. That's why he's my number one. I don't see how we could get any worse than the people we mentioned. I have a bunch of honorable mentions that I don't even want to get into. I will post them online when I post this episode. But that is our top five. We went long, but hopefully it was entertaining. I don't know. Rob, you're the new guy. You're the new guy this week. What did you think of our top five? And is there any particular choice that you completely disagree with and just can't believe that was mentioned or wasn't mentioned?
No, I think I definitely think I agree. I think everybody had a lot of valid points to it. I mean, there was a lot of guys that I definitely consider that other people mentioned that, for one reason or another, I said, nah, I'm not going to put him on there. But I don't think there was anybody that I thought, you know what, there was a 100% successful gimmick, and he was a world champion from the time he walked out, no matter how stupid it was. So,
Rock.
You know, I think everybody – well, I was trying to be nice and not bury the guy, but, yeah, the Rock kick was just brutally awful. That guy, when the Rock walked out, he was – the build-up to his debut at Survivor Series was essentially, this guy's going to be world champion, and that's how they started with him. So I didn't think Flash Funk was going to be world champion, but yeah, the Rock picked it. Other than that, I think everybody else had their merits to why they were, you know, a tremendously awful gimmick who never should have deserved a world title shot.
So Justin, is your streak still intact? I don't think we've missed a week yet, have we?
Unless we're going back to the very beginning, and I gotta think of the very beginning ones off the top. I probably didn't have a bad one for the theme music one, so I think we'll go with that. So yeah, so now Cam's also in my streak too because he brought up Colt Cabana and the end of the current NWA titles. So we'll count him as on the streak too.
Okay, so you're just throwing him under the bus right now just because he's not on the show.
Exactly.
Okay. That being said, I don't know if we will be back here again next week. Rob will not be back here again next week. We are not subjecting him to being a weekly a part of this crew. It's just a little too much. But we might be back again next week. We will update you during the week. Just to see what our results for the Money in the Bank pay-per-view. It depends on how newsworthy the show is and whether or not we're going to record or we will take next week off and come back the following week. We will let you know through various social media and through htcwrestling.com. I want to thank you again, Rob, for joining us again this week. What's the Twitter account again, just to throw it out there?
WWE Creative_ISH.
All right, that's where you can find him every Monday night, sometimes Friday, every now and then over the weekend for TNA. Not usually on Thursday because everybody's got something better to do on Thursday than watch Impact. But that's it for us tonight. Thank you again for listening. Leave us comments, send us emails, post your top five. We want to hear back from you. I'm your host, Matt Herrick. HTCWrestling.com, InsidePulse.com. Thanks again for joining us tonight.